is really overwhelming. And I would suggest that there's probably something here for most of you. Well, I want to do one more thing before we go home, because if I get this out of the way, then we can tackle something else tomorrow. First, just very quickly, I want to get this idea across. If you still believe that those are important, please forget it. They are not important. Facts have very, very little to do with the building of public relationships. Public relationships are not built in the head. They're built in the heart and in the gut. Now, facts still have a place in public relations, but it isn't in the initial building of relationships. Okay? Tomorrow we'll talk about what the role of facts is, but I just want to make sure you don't think that getting the facts out there or hitting them with information will do anything for you. There's no evidence for it. What we have to deal with, and the reason that we need these personal situations and we need process management, is that the raw material of public relationship is perceptions. And now you're dealing with really tough stuff. Really tough stuff. Because we need to find out what they are. Are they true perceptions, misperceptions? Do they have no perceptions? Well, that hardly ever happens. And then we need to speak to the perceptions that people have. And perceptions to public relations are facts. If Mrs. Smith thinks the clerks at your branch are rude, they are rude, even if Emily Post would verify that they weren't. Because it's her perceptions that we got to deal with if we want to keep her as a customer. Okay, second point, just to wrap up this business of behavioral sciences, and you could talk for weeks about the good tools we've been given by the behavioral scientists. There are four basic findings of the behavioral scientists that seem at this point to be relevant to what we're talking about. First of all, from sociology, is the rule of abuse. This is an interesting negative way of looking at our work, which I find a real time saver. The rule of abuse of the sociologist postulates that any change in a relationship is the result of an abuse. Any change in a relationship is the result of an abuse on the part of one of the parties. Now, that may be a real abuse. It may be factual that a jury of 12 men and women, good and true, would say, yeah, that's an abuse. It may just be a perception. And today, more and more, it may be the fear of a future abuse. The economy is going to go to hell. The bank is going to have further losses, and I'm going to get fired. You know the kind of stuff we're talking about. If people feel in a situation of abuse, they cannot even hear our communications, to say nothing of building relationships. It simply shuts them off psychologically. And you've witnessed it yourself 1,000 times. A speaker gets up in front of an audience, and the first words out of his or her mouth turn everybody off. And it's all over, isn't it? It's just all over. Or you read a piece, maybe a well-written, well-thought-out piece, but the letters of the editor are a good place to check this. Instead of giving the data first and then the conclusion, they give the conclusion first. You read the conclusion, you don't like it, you don't read anymore. Or they have a really well-reasoned piece, but they start off by saying, that jerk, why did he do this? And then they give the reasons. Well, it turns you off right away. You feel abused by it. So the rule of abuse is critical. We make abuse lists for all our publics when we do our planning. What are the real, the perceived, or the feared abuses that depositors might have about the bank or about the economy that affect the bank? And we got to deal with those first. Now, you can't always solve them. But what the sociologists and the psychologists tell us is that if you at least mention them, if you bring them up to show that you are concerned about them, then you can start communicating. Until you can, forget it. You're just wasting your time. The psychologists have the rule of participation. The rule of participation is simple. People will only get behind those decisions that they have had a voice in making. People will only get behind those decisions that they have had a voice in making. Now, you and I know that part of the voice in making, maybe I'm not too comfortable with the decision, but my peers like it. And so I am willing to give passive consent to what my peers want, but at one level or another, I must either actively participate and actively support the decision, or I must be willing to set aside my actual participation by allowing peer participation to represent me, one or the other. The third rule that proves useful is the rule of rewards. People will only do that there's something in for them. Now, we're generally good and getting better, I think, at remembering this inside our organizations. We know you got to pay people in gold braid or compliments or money or the spotlight or something to really motivate them. But it's amazing to me how often in public relations we forget this outside. What rewards are we giving people out there whose behavior is the desired behavior, the one that really works with us? What do we do for them? Oftentimes, nothing. In fact, oftentimes we kick them in the teeth. And then we wonder what happened. Then there's the rule of anthropology. I can spell it. And that's the rule of the cheerleader. The anthropologists tell us that there has never been a successful society or organization that did not have at its core a cheerleader. Someone, you know, when things are going to hell, says, rally round, we can pull it out, we're a strong organization. And when things are going good, they say, wow, this is only the beginning, you know, wave the pom-poms. This is another thing I think that managements and people in public relations have tended to poo-poo. It's so corny to have cheerleaders. And yet every organization has them. They are endemic to social life. In fact, all of this, everything I've said this morning, can really be summed up in one simple postulation. And so just before lunch, here is my simple postulation. The OD consultants, which every public relations practitioner ought to be, in my opinion, an OD consultant, talk about STS, the theory of STS. That theory simply postulates that every organization is a socio-technical system. A socio-technical system. For a long time, we believed that organizations were just technical systems. They had a task to perform, and the technology around performing that task was enough. And we could say to customers, hey, listen, never mind how I'm treating you. I delivered the product you wanted. And to employees, we could say, hey, listen, you got a job. And to the community, we could say, hey, we pay taxes. Just a technical thing. And now we know that they're far more than that. That they are socio-technical systems, that they are social systems. And that when managements can understand that the social part comes before the technical part, then we can manage at the boundaries and we can deal with people's values. And I'm glad I turned that page back, because tomorrow I will be sure to talk about divided messages. Any questions or problems? Well, be thinking about what you disagree with. But let me give you one more handout. This is one to think about. It's a definition of public relations from a new direction. One you may have thought about, you may agree with, and you may think is full of beans. But read it over. It's only a few lines. And tomorrow what we're going to talk about will pick up on it. And if you think some of the things I said were outrageous today, wait till you hear how I apply them tomorrow. Because this world is changing fast. And remember, Ron's instructions were, you're either supposed to be able to justify what you're doing now or start changing it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow morning at... Where's that in? Somebody asked for a 2-minute review of everything we did yesterday, so if you're ready, we'll launch into that. If there's one phrase that might sum up what we were talking about yesterday, it's my view that public relations has to really be effective, has to work toward desired behavior. Now, as soon as you say that, some problems flow from that. I mean, first of all, there's the whole question of, can we really motivate or reinforce people's behaviors? I mean, is that something public relations can do, or is that really beyond our scope? And frankly, I have come more and more to think that that's just begging the question. Because despite all our efforts at evaluating what public relations does, the fact is that the only thing that matters is behavior. When Roger Smith was crowned the king of General Motors 2 years ago, and Roger's a good example because, like Louis Lundborg and some others, he'd spent time in the public relations department. He was director of public relations at one point. When he took over that job, he had the luxury of giving one of those little speeches that kings get to give when they ascend the throne, and it was very brief. He said to the multitudes of GM this. He said, "I don't care whether people love our cars. The only thing I want to know is, are they buying?" Well, if you stop to think about that, I'm not sure we can duck working toward desired behaviors. But this requires an approach, a mindset, if you will, on our parts that may be a little different than the one that most of us are practicing. Now, given the fact that each of us may have a sphere in which we're working, which tends to narrow our scope a bit, nonetheless, it seems to me that unless we're willing to tackle that, we are not going to be relevant enough to be part of the group that is managing at the boundaries between the folks out there and the organization in here. The other question that this immediately raises is, what specific techniques can we use? How do we go about getting desired behaviors? Well, the one group of students of public relations say that you really have two choices. You can either practice symmetrical public relations, or you can practice asymmetrical public relations. And, you know, as you can tell right away from the terms, these are scholars talking. But the definition that they're trying to make here is that asymmetrical public relations is a more dominating, almost an attempt to be manipulative method, where the organization looks for desired behaviors outside, but expects somehow to bring those about without giving anything, without change on itself, so that the essential relationship is not dealt with. It's merely an attempt to get people to do things our way. Whereas symmetrical behavior is more like this, that if the boundary says that's what their needs and values are, then the organization would try to change its product, service, culture, whatever, to fit those needs and values out there. So this is a cooperative method, and this is more a dominating method, an attempt to really get people to do what we want to do without making any changes. It might be instructive at this point to take just a minute and ask each of you to think about that and to evaluate your own work and your assignments in the bank along those lines, but usually that's kind of a downer, because the fact of the matter seems to be that we spend an awful lot of our energy here. Now, the people who are looking into this are doing so for one simple reason. They have been impressed with the thousands of cases that they've looked at the difficulty of really making this happen in the modern world, all of the things we talked about yesterday, to really get other people to do things because we want them to do them, is extremely difficult, if not impossible. So we're left then with some means of moving our relationships with the people into such a state that we indeed know one another well enough that we can have symmetrical behavior. Well, how do you get there? Well, maybe this is a good time to talk about what we know about persuasion. Let's assume we have a relationship. We've been able to work with some people over time. Maybe we've been able to get their confidence on one or two occasions. Maybe we're moving toward that position of trust, which is, as we said yesterday, the repetition of those confidences. Nonetheless, there has to be some kind of an exchange of views back and forth. So what do we know in exchanging these views about really persuading people, particularly larger audiences? Actually, there are six methods that have been identified for persuading, and only six. The first is the rational or logical method. And for reasons that I'll explain in a minute, that doesn't work most of the time. The reason it doesn't work partly goes back to our discussion yesterday of the diffusion process and the simple fact that people need peer reinforcement. And if I could find it here. Well, the number of folks you remember who are innovators is very small. A person that does not need peer reinforcement might very well be persuaded by the rational method, because they're going to consider the facts and say, well, that sounds good to me. I will buy that product, use that service, vote for that candidate, or whatever. But for the great majority of people, this has another purpose. The scholars of persuasion tell us that the importance of the rational method is really to persuade the persuader first. In other words, if I can't make a rational case for whatever it is I want to persuade you of, inevitably through body language and other means, I will reveal that to you. And I will let you know that I'm not really convinced that this is the right thing. And so every persuasion must begin here. Every attempt at persuasion begins here with actually setting the case. The reason fundraisers start by putting together a case statement is not just to show the case statement to those they'd like to raise money from, but first is to look at it themselves and say, you know, does this really make sense? Does this have any value? So all persuasion begins with the persuader being very sure that a case can be made. Now, of course, there's another element here for those of us who practice public relations, and that is, this is really where ethics comes in. Because if we can't make a strong, rational case that this has some benefits for the publics we're working with, not just selfish benefits, probably we have no damn business trying to persuade anybody of anything. So the rational method is one method, but it has those limits. Once we know we've got a case, once we're comfortable that we can go out and really sell it and we're not going to reveal our doubts because we didn't have a rational case, then there are five methods that plug into what really persuades people. And the first method is known as the association method. And the association method does just that. It associates whatever we're trying to persuade people about with something they already have been persuaded about. For example, when a politician gets up to give a speech and tell us that we ought to vote for him or her because they'll be so wonderful, on the stage with them is usually the American flag, or the flag of whatever country they're speaking in, or whatever the symbol is in their country that says, I'm okay. They associate themselves with this already accepted symbol. When Ronnie Reagan gets up to tell us that Star Wars will work, never mind those scientists who have to build it, I'm telling you it'll work, right here in the podium is always the great seal of the President of the United States. So that whatever face is behind that podium, we immediately, through association, are partly persuaded, because the symbol reminds us. When people come on television commercials and they are trying to sell us aspirin, what are they wearing? Almost inevitably a white coat. The actor is wearing a white coat with a stethoscope down here. Now, we know it's just an actor. It's not really Dr. Jones from down the street, but the purpose is clear. Association. Interestingly enough, this is another one of those methods that we have considered corny. And you see very little of this in public relations practice any longer. Just the simple associations. If you're going to use the association method, of course, it also pays to know what has already been universally accepted by Americans, whether it's a word, whether it's a symbol, a color. For example, if you want to make an association that is going to reach the most people in the United States, then you want to try and associate with the tree. The tree is the single most accepted idea, the most loved idea by almost a factor of 3 to 1 by Americans. 90% of Americans have very, very strong favorable feelings toward trees. Don't ask me to explain it, but the research is absolutely crystal clear. And this is why you'll see drugstores that have trees on their sign. You know, and you'll see businesses that have nothing to do with outdoors or wood products or anything, and they're using the tree or some form of the tree, because the tree is accepted as a symbol of strength and beauty and stability. And those kind of associations, whether it's symbols or words, are persuasive. Another kind of persuasive method is the motivational method. The motivational method was really created, if you will, as a method by Dr. Ernest Dichter and other advertising research people in the 1950s. And they simply realized that it wasn't always good to tell how wonderful your product was and what it would do for the world, but rather to segment your target audience and find out their specific motivations and then talk to those motivations. And obviously don't talk about those things which are demotivators to that group. We all know this, we all do this subconsciously, but it is, particularly on specific products or services, a valuable method. Now, if you're going to use a motivational method, then one ought to know Harold Laswell's list of what the 8 motivators are for Americans. If I could remember it, I would even share it with you, but I'm not sure I can. Let's see. The most important motivator, the one that most people accept, is the motivation of status. Who am I? Because probably most Americans are very unsure on this question. Status, therefore, is the single number one motivator. And you don't have to look too far in advertising and product design to see how this works in our society. The second most important motivator is the question of being liked, being loved, being accepted. Wealth is the third most. Health is the fourth most. Learning, knowledge, is the fifth most. The sixth most is being seen as a servant of society, as a person who really cares about one's fellows. And then there are a couple of others in there somehow that fail me right at the moment. Laswell's list, if anybody wants Laswell's list, give me your business card and I'll be glad to send it to you. But it is interesting to note that we know what the motivators are, and if we know them and know something about our target audience, we can put those two together and be very directly persuasive, particularly if we're good at targeting our audiences and getting an audience profile. The fourth method, and probably the most powerful, is called social rewards and punishments. I think we all understand this method. The implication is that your peers approve or disapprove, but it goes far beyond that. It has a subliminal aspect to it, and this you will see often in advertising. For example, where is the Mercedes-Benz always parked in the ads? It's always parked outside this huge mansion or outside the club, and there's always this guy there who's just a little bit gray in here, you know, and he's very slim and suave, and he's kind of standing around like this. I don't know why they always stand around like this. And then there's always this blonde who's about 8'2" in this skimpy dress, you know, and she's always leaning over the hood, right? You ever notice that in those ads? And it's usually kind of misty, too. I mean, I don't know what they're doing out there at 4 a.m. in front of the club, but look, it's not up to us to ask. And the implication is clear. If you had a Mercedes, this is the kind of life you would live. It would be a social reward for you to have a Mercedes. I did a study once for the Cooperative Extension Service for a series of films they were doing to help us buyers beware of what's being sold to us through advertising. And it was absolutely amazing to me. Just you can leaf through any magazine, and ad after ad after ad is trying to tell us this in one way or another. Social punishments is a very powerful persuasive method. I I guess it's one most of us would prefer not to use. But I had occasion recently, we had occasion in our firm where we simply couldn't avoid using it. A hospital that we've been counseling to try and stay alive in the modern competitive environment of healthcare had a little problem. One of its doctors, like physicians since time immemorial, considered himself really a man of letters. And so he talked the local newspaper into letting him write a column every Wednesday. And they were nice when they started out. You know, he told you what to do with hangnails and how to know whether you had some fatal disease. But then the politics of the changes inside the hospital started to take his mind over. And the first thing you knew, every Wednesday was coming out this polemic on his view of hospital politics, generally taking the administration to task and finally absolutely ripping them apart. Well, you know, that really isn't fair. This guy was part of the system, and yet then he also could go outside the system on Wednesday and do this. Well, first we did a little study for the board of directors to show them that nobody read the damn column, so it didn't make any difference, which is exactly what the study showed. And those who did thought it was funny. But the fact remained that it did make the doctors mad. And so while it was having no effect whatsoever outside, it was making the doctors mad and creating an internal problem. And the only way we could deal with it, we talked to this fellow, we had opinion leaders talk to this guy, and he just wouldn't stop. He kept talking about his First Amendment rights, which of course is correct, he had them. But still there's a thing called organizational fairness. You can't both be inside and partake of the good and then run outside and shoot bombs back in. So we called the doctors together and we just went over a little bit of this and said, if you want to shut Charlie off, you are going to have to do it with some social punishments. And 2 weeks after they all started either speaking harshly to him in the hall or absolutely avoiding him, 2 weeks, he quit and went to another hospital. And he'd been there for 24 years. Humans simply cannot stand that kind of pressure. They simply cannot stand it. Social rewards and punishments is very powerful. But there is a more powerful method known as whole personality. The whole personality method essentially takes all of these into account. It tries to look at people as people, not just as parts of the methods that we use to make our decisions. And so, in the whole personality method, the rule is to try and get a personality profile of the public that you're targeting. I think most of you are familiar with the research methods by which we do that. If you're not, I'll talk in a minute about the major one, sociographic method called VALS, which is probably the best map we have of American personality anyway. You can trace the whole personality method maybe most easily, for an example, by looking at the causes that people have been attracted to in recent times. I spoke yesterday a little bit about the resurgence of modern activism at the New London Naval Base in the 50s and how that then moved into the civil rights movement. And if you'll think for just a minute about the personality profile of someone who may have been concerned in the 50s about nuclear warfare and blowing up the world, you'll see that that's a somewhat similar personality profile that would move then into civil rights and be concerned that there be fair sharing in society. And those same people then moved, or people with a similar personality profile. You cannot ever say it'll be the same person. But a similar personality profile moved into civil liberties. Then they were into environment and into ending the Vietnamese War. And a very similar personality prototype. Then in the late 70s, they all went off into holistic health and Zen Buddhism and contemplating your navel. I don't know how to explain that one. But it is pretty much the same personality profile. And now they're re-emerging again on the nuclear issue, on peace. Now they've sort of put nuclear power, nuclear war, ending war into a kind of a package. And if you were to look at the values, the attitudes, the lifestyles, the general personality profile of those people, they're somewhat similar. Well, I use that only as an example to show that we can get a profile. And if we know what that profile is and can speak to the whole person, that's probably the best persuasive method that we have. You'll notice two things about all of this, and I hope that this has probably come through in everything that I've been saying. One, knowing the methodology, the technology, the science is wonderful, but you also have to have some research about your target public. You got to know who they are. Where are they in terms of knowledge and ignorance of the subject? What about their attitudes? And what about their behaviors, their lifestyles? So in addition to knowing the technology, we have to do some research.